We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When it's too tough for them, it's just right for us.
Where would you rather be than right here, right now?
The Rockpile Report with Buffalo Bills season ticket holder Drew Gear.
The Bills make me wanna.
The passion that they have for this city, for this team. I mean, we even talked about the Buffalo Sabres. We talked about resources. We talked about stability. They checked every box when I went through it. I had questions going in. You have to. When you're leaving an organization like Carolina, you've been there 19 years, something has to blow you away to leave. And this was a different interview. And it just, Terry and Kim, we're going to have every resource we need to turn this thing around and build a contender here. And the goal is to sustain success.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Rockpile Report podcast. I am your host, Buffalo Bills season ticket holder Drew Gear. That is my producer, Chris Krueger. And tonight, in studio, we have a very special guest.
Nate Geary.
It's because North Collins was, you know, barely a school.
Host of Breakfast with the Bills.
You're in big trouble, though, pal. I eat pieces of shit like you for breakfast.
On WGR Sports Radio 550.
You eat pieces of shit for breakfast?
No.
Big French crumble! I'm funky like a rubber band. I'm a lapis-eyed devil.
Woo! We got Nate Geary in the house, everybody. How you doing, Nate?
I'm doing great, because every time I'm on your guys' podcast, I get a better intro than I technically give myself on my own damn radio show. So I thoroughly enjoy it.
The whole theme was breakfast.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'll tell you. You can thank Chris for that. He puts a lot of effort into it. Now, folks, that audio you just heard actually came from Brandon Bean, the new Bills GM. Now, Nate, we've got you here on the show with us tonight. For those of you, we have a lot of listeners who aren't from here, you know, aren't local. You know, okay. We got a lot of out-of-towners.
Some from Uganda.
Guys, some guys from Uganda, from across the pond over in England.
Just a quick drive.
So, just to kind of familiarize these people with who you are. First and foremost, you work for WGR 550. Mm-hmm. You are an on-air personality. You have shows that you sit in on or sometimes that you run yourself. I guess we've been talking recently, you've taken on some new responsibilities. So what is it that you're doing right now for WGR?
So now for the flagship station of the Bills and Sabres. Basically, I've sort of created my niche in the football, the NFL, the Buffalo Bills. That's kind of my niche there at WGR. You know, I can do it all. I can talk about the other sports. But, you know, it's just kind of my personal preferences, football and the Bills. You know, I grew up a season ticket holder myself. I grew up about, I don't know, maybe half a mile down the street from the stadium. So I'm real local in terms of how close in proximity I live to the stadium. But now, basically, you know, as a 25-year-old, I would call myself a radio entrepreneur. I guess I would call myself that. Now that I'm... I'm not necessarily there full time, but I've sort of taken over full time, host duties. So I've really kind of moved away from the production portion of radio and kind of really focusing in on the hosting and this year, you know, we'll be still kind of waiting to see what happens with my role. But last year, my role was on the pregame show, as mentioned, the Breakfast with the Bills show, and then the halftime show with Sal and I, me interviewing Sal essentially from the website, from the stadium, whether it's home or away, and then the post-game show, the we call it the overtime show, which is the post-game show. And last year I got my first real taste of real post-game, because technically my post-game show follows Chopin Bulldog at usually about an hour and a half after the end of the game. Last year, however, I got my first real chance to host the actual network post-game, so the Buffalo Bills Radio Network post-game show on the Thursday night game, week two, against the Jets.
How did that go?
It was difficult because there was sort of a rush of emotion following that game. Just them losing that game and no reason to lose that game to Ryan Fitzpatrick. And
I'll tell you this. I know for a fact that I'm guilty of being the guy who has one too many Chardonnays during the course of a Bills game, and then calls the radio station and just kicks the teeth in whoever picks up the phone.
I'll tell you though, for that really being my first time running that show, I was really nervous to start. You know, there was that sort of like bean in your throat kind of thing. Where you're trying to not sound like a nervous, you know, amateur when you're on the radio. And for me, that game, it quickly...
That was the Widowmaker. You got thrown into the fire.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, on any show, you kind of want that form, the structure of your radio show. And I had felt it kind of getting away from me, the structure of the show. And what I ended up doing is just kind of, you know, thinking to myself, I'm thinking, what do people want to hear right now? Mm-hmm. People don't want to hear necessarily negativity. They don't want to hear why they suck. They want to hear a little bit of emotion. They want to hear somebody on the radio say what they're thinking on their drive home.
Yep.
So that's kind of like where I went with it. And, you know, it was one
for you.
It was a rant, probably my most famous rant.
The first of many.
It was, and then they, you know, they told me, reel it back there, Nate. Remember who you work for. And I said, okay, we'll do.
So now, outside of the WGR radio station where you work, you also do some work for CoverOne.net. That's a pro. A lot of our listeners are very familiar with their material. You've done a lot of pre-draft stuff with them. And that's actually part of the reason Nate's here tonight, is to kind of work with us as far as we talk about the draft and everything else. You know, there was a specialty piece he did that we're going to touch on in a little bit as we kind of work our way through draft recap for the Buffalo Bills. But as we do every week, we're going to kick things off with this week's Bills News Update. First off, Jalen Robinette signs with the Buffalo Bills for a rookie tryout. Now, I know I wouldn't be shocked out there if most of you don't recognize the name of the player, because he's not a household name by any stretch. He was a wide receiver for Air Force University in college. And given the triple option kind of wonky offense that they ran there, he didn't get a whole lot of national recognition as a wide receiver.
Except for like during the draft process.
Well, during the draft process, because that's when statistics come into play. And that's when you look at someone's physical, you know, you look at them, just their physical makeup, and then what they've done statistically. He's a wide receiver who's 6'3", 220 pounds. And even though he ran a slow 40 time, I mean, he ran a 4.6, which is a wide receiver. I mean, I get it. He's a big wide receiver, so you don't think he's going to run a 4.4.
Right.
But he led the nation in 2016 for collegiate football with 27.4 yards per catch. He was all first team Mountain West Conference, and he's one of those wide receivers who, you know, he's a guy that they talked about in the same vein that they talked about. What was the wide receiver?
James Hardy.
No, the wide receiver that got drafted in the second round by
Stephen Hill.
No, yeah, Stephen Hill.
From Georgia Tech.
From Georgia Tech.
That was on the second try.
So now this is a street free agent, a guy who kind of walked in here undrafted. But now here's the reason why, and this is what makes it so interesting, him being brought in. The reason I was is kind of intrigued me is that he's kind of a victim of a weird set of circumstances.
They're fucking with him.
Last year there was a bill passed. Now I don't know if any of you out there who are collegiate football fans remember Navy. Navy's team was very good. They were ranked at one point.
Don't tell me the quarterback's name. Reynolds.
Keenan Reynolds.
Keenan Reynolds.
Keenan Reynolds was drafted in the sixth round because a bill was passed basically stating that, look, our athletes who come here and play, some of them may be good enough to play in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, and if they're offered a contract by a pro sports team, that could help our collegiate recruiting efforts.
Absolutely.
As far as, hey, mm-hmm. here's athletes.
Worst case scenario,
you don't get offered a pro contract.
Mm-hmm. Now you have a job.
Now you've attended it. You know you have a mm-hmm. job, and you're going to be in the military for at least 2 years after you graduate. So they saw it as a recruiting opportunity. So they signed this bill that allowed Keenan Reynolds to be drafted and to forego his military duties for those 2 years afterwards. He basically gets put on a reserve status. He will serve at some point, mm-hmm. just not right now. Now, last year the bill got signed. Well, this year they revoked it the day.
Thanks a lot, Trump.
The day of the draft. So here's all these teams who have their draft boards drawn up, and I'm sure Robinette's name on a lot of them came up somewhere, the sixth, seventh round. Hey, here's a guy, if he's there late, we'll take a flyer on him. We'll see if he's worth that draft pick. Mm-hmm. Instead, he went undrafted because the news broke the day
and
of the draft.
Him.
And
right.
teams didn't know what to do, so they just didn't do anything. No one drafted him. Now, the bill is under review, so it may still be possible for Robinette to play this year. You know, it still hasn't come out whether or not it's going to be repealed or whether it's going to be changed. I just think that it's interesting to see not only the player because of the skill set he brings to the right. Bills, but also it's a good storyline to keep an eye on when it comes to collegiate recruiting. When you think about how is that going to hurt Navy, Army, Air Force, I don't know. That's going to really hamstring their abilities to put together decent sports teams or recruit athletes who maybe want to join the Air Force, maybe mm-hmm. want to join the Navy. You know, they want to go to the Naval Academy. They know they have the grades to get in. They're the type of athlete that they would love to have, but because they have that pro talent, they actually skip out on being part of the armed services altogether because they think they have a shot at going pro.
I'll tell you, you know, coming from that system, I grew up playing in the triple option at Frontier. And, you know, a lot of guys, unfortunately, in that system can sort of get lost in translation because mm-hmm. they're playing in an offensive scheme that doesn't necessarily highlight the best parts of their game. And in his case, in Robinette's case, you have a guy who's got the size and skill to be an NFL receiver. Now, I mean, when you look at some of these guys in the league that are over 6'3", none of them are running 4.4s. It's just, it's at that size and the strides that you're taking, and it's very difficult to be running a sub-4.4, sub-4.5 time when you're that size. However, you're talking about a guy with great, as you said, you know, yards per catch averages, but someone that I'm certainly interested in. And now, I mean, you bring this up. I look at, and today, for instance, in Joe Biscaglia from WKBW, he's the sports director over there now. He posted an article of his, you know, way too early 53-man roster update and kind of who was going to make the team, who's going to get cut at each position. And one of the, you know, positions that he really kind of got into was the wide receiver position. And, you know, you talk about a guy like Robinette, but then you talk about a guy like Colby Listenby, mm-hmm. Guys who haven't necessarily, who have been on the roster, Des Lewis, guys who have been on the roster for a few years now, or in Listenby's case, at least a year, wasn't able to play because due to injury. Mm-hmm. The wide receiver position, to me, is pretty deep, even though, I mean, going into this draft, we're like, oh, man, we really need a receiver. Are we going to take one in the first round? And then all of a sudden there's a run of three receivers in the top nine picks who nobody saw coming. And then you're like, okay, well, maybe we really need to add to this receiver position. But you get Zay Jones, and now you're looking at the receiver position as maybe a position of depth strength, especially on the offensive side of the ball.
I think we looked at that last year with linebackers. Mm-hmm. And we got Braglin and Brown and Lorax.
Right.
And last year they were fantastic.
Yeah.
I honestly look at this guy and I look at our depth chart, and I say there hasn't been any news as to whether or not he's been officially signed yet. But the thing I like about him is that he brings something that no one else on our roster has right now. Size and the ability to just bang with cornerbacks down the field. I mean, he's so big. And I went back and watched a lot of his highlights and a lot of his film. And you see him, even when he's not making completions, there's not a cornerback out there who can really shove him around.
Right.
Because he's so big. And he's fast. He's not. He's never going to blow anyone away with his speed, but he's fast enough to get down the field. And if you think that you're going to try to jockey with him for position, he's going to outjump you. He's going to catch balls outside of his frame. He's got a big catch radius. That's a guy in a West Coast offense.
Catch radius is a thing that you got to really pay attention to when you're not even talking about the West Coast offense, but just Tyrod Taylor in general.
Well, yeah.
And that's a guy who doesn't necessarily.
He's going to put it around you.
Correct.
But if that's a wide receiver who, hey, even when, if you put a 5'11" corner on him, he's already open.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's going to be hard for that cornerback to even fight to get to the ball. So as long as it's somewhat accurate, you could. Over a guy like Dez Lewis, I would take this kid all day long.
Mm-hmm. And then, I agree with that completely. By the way, before we really hop into the front office situation here, I don't really get to plug products on my show. It's in my contract. I'm not allowed to plug products. Mm-hmm. This Moosehead Lager is divine.
It's Nate here is getting his first taste of Moosehead Lager, folks.
We like it.
It is smooth yet refreshing, especially on this warm spring day.
And as Nate can attest to, behind us as we're recording
is a wall of Moosehead. A wall of moose.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
16, 17, 18,
something of legends. But I'll tell you what, usually like my beer of choice is, you know, your typical Labatt Blue Light. I'm a pretty simple Buffalonian, but at the same time, this Moosehead reminds me a lot of Rolling Rock keg beer.
Yes.
It reminds me of a Rolling Rock keg beer, and I've never really felt more at home than I do right now.
Thanks for joining us.
And cheers to that.
So, up next, one of the things that came across the news today that, again, it's not something that directly impacts the Bills. You know, that's not what piqued my... Well, I guess it is because it ties into the Bills in my mind. The NFL... Now, NFL owners are meeting next Monday in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And rule changes are always on the docket when it comes to this type of stuff. One of these changes might mean a lot to the Buffalo Bills in 2017 and beyond. It's been floated that the owners are expected to pass a change to the return from IR designation.
Which I love.
Now, in the past, once you were on IR, you were there forever. The last two seasons, they've allowed you to bring one player back per season. And this year, they didn't make you, the first year, you had to designate them right out of the gate. Now, they kind of gave you an option that you could wait until 8 weeks and then decide if you wanted to bring
them back.
Which
is essentially an extended PUP list.
Exactly. But you're just extending the PUP list. Well, now they're talking about bringing back two players in the same fashion. You don't have to declare who, just 8 weeks, and if they can't come back at 8 weeks, then they stay on the IR. But if they can, you can bring them back. Now, I think about that, and then what I think back to is, if you guys remember, the Bills were in the top five last season for man games lost due to the IR designation and injury. Most of that revolved around the wide receiver position.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about it, when we were going into games, critical games, the Steelers game, the Miami Dolphins game.
Oakland.
Mm-hmm. And you're trotting out wide receivers like Dez Lewis, who really just hasn't been able to do anything on an NFL field. He just can't. I mean, during the preseason, he looks all right, but he can't show up on game day. Wouldn't it have been nice to be able to bring back a guy like Greg Salas?
Mm-hmm.
To have just a guy, somebody with the NFL experience who's proven he can catch a ball or two. So, because before Sammy came back, we had nothing.
Yeah.
I will applaud this change if it is in fact made, given that we are one of the more injury-ravaged teams in the
NFL.
For
whatever reason, right.
Year after year after year, I'll take any help I can get on that front. And I mean... Just, we have a banged up team usually by about week 7 or 8, right? Usually we're already.
It seems like every year,
Every year we're having that conversation. Hopefully, we're kind of banking on that to change with the coaching staff change, with the change in personnel, the medical staff changes, and things like that. But ultimately, the fact that we could bring another guy back, not just one, but two that you can target who maybe. One of my nightmare scenario is that Sammy Watkins gets hurt again in training camp or gets hurt again in the preseason, re-aggravates whatever this foot thing is. And in that case, you have to put him on the IR and you can bring him back when he's ready. But it mandates the first 8 weeks. Well, now you've already given up that designation.
Right.
It can't be you. So if there's a fluke injury week two to a player who probably needs 7 weeks, wouldn't you want him back at some point that year?
Yeah. And I mean... I guess for me, the rule is going to really go into guys. And I mean, this rule would have helped the Bills last year. There's not a question in my mind. The idea that you can get one guy right now, I think, to help. I mean, Shaq Lawson, I believe, that was that guy last year. But you looked at it, there was, you know, rumors that Reggie Ragland would have been available. But clearly, you know, as he moves into camp now, he's still kind of feeling the ill effects from that knee injury that he had in training camp last year. But either way you spin it, I think it's a good rule for the league. I think the league needs to continue looking at different ways to make players available on the field, because at the end of the day, the product is about the players, and that's one of my main focuses about this whole Josh Gordon situation, about his suspension. Is, you know, this is one of the premier wide receivers, one of the premier players in the league, and unfortunately, you have a league that's keeping him out of the lineup on a week-to-week basis and a year-to-year at this point basis, and who do you want to see? You want to see the league's best players, and you need to figure out a way to make sure that if a guy is able to come back and play in week 12 after hurting himself in week 1, that each team has the opportunity to bring that guy back, especially if he's a key contributor.
I mean, you want to bring up Josh Gordon. Here's a thing I don't understand. You're talking about a guy who's been in trouble for smoking pot. Now, I understand that marijuana, by definition of the league rules, is a prohibited substance. You're not allowed to do it. And I also understand the fact that, you know, like, I work for a manufacturing company. And because I work for a manufacturing company, they drug test. And marijuana is on the list of substances you're not allowed to have. So there could be, you know, you're talking about guys who work in a factory.
Nate, you know where I work? In a manufacturing place. Except we don't drug test.
Wow. So that's the world I'm trying to live in. Both of my jobs don't drug test. But you could test me anytime.
And you'll be clean?
I've got pee somewhere that'll be clean.
So what I know is that I look at this and I say, okay, my company has the right to say to me, hey, even if I don't have a good reason, it doesn't matter that you're not manning machinery. It doesn't matter that you're not down there working in the factory.
Right.
We don't want you doing this as someone who's working for our company.
I can understand.
They're not forcing me to work there. Therefore, I shouldn't assume that they would want this thing going on in their building. And if that's the rule, that's the rule. But one of the things I don't understand is when you see how the NFL applies the suspension stuff, when it comes down to stuff like, let's talk about Alden Smith. Alden Smith has been arrested for bringing a gun into an airport, getting into a fight with security, threatening to blow things up, shooting an AK-47 at a party at his house.
No. Oh, I thought that was Jet Kelly.
Shooting an AK-47 at a party at his house. He was stabbed in that incident. Just a number of infractions that have led to him being suspended, and yet there's talk of him being reinstated.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about reinstating this guy who clearly makes poor decisions, but you won't reinstate a guy who
is trying, in theory, trying to rehabilitate and be a player that can abide by the rules of the league, here's where I think just a blanket statement. I agree that there is a time and place, and let's just get this out of the way now. Josh Gordon isn't using marijuana for medicinal uses. He's just not. Now, do I necessarily still think that there is a time and place? I think there's a time and place for everything. However, you know, I think that if I'm a player and I'm a recreational user of marijuana, that my biggest gripe is no employer is going to allow you to smoke on around the workplace. It's just that's the way it happens. It's not acceptable. And I'm a firm believer of that, as I wouldn't expect my employer to allow me to come and light up at their place of business. It's just that's not what you would do.
Yeah.
However, when you're talking about the months of January until July, I don't care what my player is doing as long as he's staying out of trouble. And if it's legal in his state, if it's legal in his county, if it's legal in whatever it is, he should be allowed to do whatever he wants as long as he's staying out of the media spotlight, out of a jail cell. It doesn't matter what he does. However, when you come to camp in July, as a team, I think this is sort of what it needs to be, is it needs to be a team policy, sort of like the government has decided for the most part to leave us to the states. I think it needs to be a team policy that when you come through my doors on July 7th for OTAs and you're here for training camp and here for the regular season, that shit's out the window. But when you're outside the realms of this organization, this structure, what you do is your own prerogative. You're an adult. You're a male. You're a male adult. Do what you want, but stay out of trouble. I don't care what you do, but stay out of trouble. And as long as this isn't affecting your on-field play, you're not missing time due to being arrested for possession of marijuana or something along those lines. And just so you know, it's very difficult to be arrested for possession of marijuana unless you have it in your vehicle while you're driving and you have like over an ounce of it. So like
where this ties back into the Bills for me is I look at a situation like Chantrell Henderson.
Totally different though.
But the league doesn't think so.
Right.
And this is where I have a problem with where all this is headed. I understand that you don't want people to abuse it, so you say, okay, we're just going to ironclad policy, no marijuana. Here is a guy who, and we did a big report on it last year, we did a big thing about how, you know, I kind of broke down, so I actually went in and found a lot of medical research that basically spoke to the fact that THC really does help the recovery process.
It's one of the only things
for anyone suffering from IBS related illnesses.
It's one of the only natural remedies that is not only proven to work, is the cheapest, and also has no significant side effects or long-term effects.
And so when I look at that and I say, okay, so you're suspending this guy for recreational use. Okay, I understand why you would do that.
I can get on your bandwagon about that.
But then when you tell me, here's a guy who's doing it because his doctors have told him it's in the best interest of his long-term health that he do it. You can't tell me then in the same breath that you care about player safety because here's a guy who's been... And it's as simple as, hey, do you have a doctor somewhere? And I understand there are the counterpoint to that is, well, they could pay a doctor.
Of course.
Of course they could. But you can't exclude people who are doing this for their health.
Yeah.
Just because there's people out there who would abuse it.
Last statement on this is what I'd like and what I'd like for a lot of things is just a lot of common sense ruling. When you look at the situation, I'd like the league, I'd like the front offices, I'd like the teams, I'd like the medical staffs, I'd like the training staffs to acknowledge the fact that opiates are indeed addictive and super dangerous for if you overuse or misuse those prescription pain medications. There has really been no admittance to this at this point.
No.
Where, listen, we understand this is an issue. We shouldn't be feeding our players on average. The average NFL player will take 100 prescription pain pills over the course of a season. The average NFL player. So when you do that, when you're putting that number in there, and when you're talking about such a terrible, not only opiate epidemic, but we're talking about a heroin epidemic, just torching our population, shouldn't there be some common sense thinking of, hey, how can we help our players in this league who are suffering from chronic pain, who are suffering from debilitating injuries that have been sort of over the course of your career? Like, that's what happens over the course of a career. You have a lot of injuries. I think being able to be open-minded now that you're in 2017, we're not in 1970 anymore. We know that marijuana doesn't make you want to kill your roommate or doesn't make you want to...
Like the movie Reefer Madness?
Right, doesn't want to make you run around naked.
The guy smokes a joint and then gets in his car and
machete. Right, like
the guy smokes a joint in a closet in Reefer Madness. It was a film from the 1970s.
Oh, I remember it.
He takes a couple puffs. They made us watch it in health class. He takes a couple puffs off a joint. Then he gets in his car, mows down a bunch of people, goes home, gets into a fight with all of his friends, and shoots his girlfriend.
Right. That stuff doesn't happen. So it's keeping an open mind, but realizing that as a league, you owe it to your players. Because, I mean, look at this concussion lawsuit. Look at these other lawsuits that are coming on league. This is ultimately going to cost the league significant amount of money. It's in their best interest.
Even just to fight these lawsuits is going to cost them millions. They should just do what, like you said, common sense.
Common sense. It's like gun laws. It's like anything else. Have common sense to be able to bring ideas to the table and not immediately shoot them down because you're, you know, morally against something.
Drew, this sounds like it's a topic for a future Rockpile Report.
A full
Rockpile Report investigate.
Oh, the Rockpile Report investigates. We haven't done one of those
investigatory
in a while.
Journalism.
Oh, yes. That was my favorite kind in school. That was probably some of my favorite courses I took.
July is going to be boring, so we should plan that.
It sure is.
July is going to be boring, but I'll tell you what hasn't been boring. The last couple weeks around One Bills Drive, because there's been a lot of fresh faces. Now, The front office for the Buffalo Bills is finally coming into focus as they introduce Brandon Bean, Joe Schoen, and Brian Ganey.
I believe it's Joe Shane.
It is
Joe
pronounced Shane.
Shane.
It Shane. It's like Seamus.
I've been calling him Schoen for weeks. That's now. Fine. This is hilarious.
That's fine.
So, I mean, first and foremost, let's get together, you, Chris, and I, Nate, and let's talk about this. Now, first and foremost, the tail of the tape on GM Brandon Bean. 19 years of NFL experience with the Carolina Panthers. He started out as an intern, then moved his way up into football operations, became the director of football operations, then found his way to interim GM and then assistant GM of the team all over the course of his 19 years with one franchise. I mean, the guy is the definition of a grinder. He has a vast knowledge and experience base. Covers a whole, just a gamut of topics. You're talking about film and player evaluations, contract negotiation, pro and collegiate scouting. He's been involved in every single one of these processes in some capacity for the Carolina Panthers. And he's obviously familiar with Sean McDermott.
Right.
I mean, there's some familiarity there. Now, Bean was introduced to the local media last week, and that's where we got to hear our new GM speak for the first time. And I mean, there wasn't a lot in the way of groundbreaking commentary.
Of course not.
A lot of that stuff, when you hear those press conferences, I mean, short of the Doug Whaley press conference.
I'll tell you what, sexy's out the window. Rex is gone. There is no more sexy.
Bland press conferences are pretty much the norm throughout the NFL. But there were a few things that stuck out to me. Now, from our show's intro, you can hear the way that Bean talked about his meeting with ownership. It almost sounds to me like the interview that they had, that the Pegulas had with Brandon Bean, was more about selling him on the caveats of our organization and their commitment to building a winning team than it was simply just, hey, here's a guy who wants a job, we're going to bring him in and vet his qualifications.
I think it goes to the resources that Pegula can offer. So Pegula's probably his number one sell, with not only with the Bills but with the Sabres, is
you're coming to the richest owner in sports.
Yeah, I have money, I will spend it.
Right.
And then people are like, well, that sounds like good resources.
Now, of course, we're talking about two different organizations, but they're both, you know, pertinent to what we're talking about. And I think maybe, and to speak a little bit about what you were talking about, is what exactly needed to be sold in a meeting with a guy like Brandon Bean, who is leaving a pretty prestigious organization, who he essentially was told, you're the GM in waiting.
You are the GM waiting in the wings. And he gave that up because he could have waited. Now, the thing with the Carolina
Panthers, who knows how long he would have waited.
Dave Gettleman is 66 years old, which he's pretty old.
In terms of,
Now, that's the GM for the Carolina
Panthers. Now, if you're 66 years old and you're listening to the podcast, of course, you are a young man. Don't you worry.
But at 66, Dave Gettleman was just handed the job a couple years ago. He's fought his whole career to get that job. He's not going to retire anytime soon.
No.
So if you are Brandon Bean, you come into the, you see that.
You wait for an opportunity.
You know that, hey, if he does retire, great. But it's going to take me a while to get that job that I've been grinding for my whole life. So, but to your point, you know, it wasn't, he was waiting in the wings. He was basically told, listen, you're going to be the guy if you just stick this out for long enough. I think that kind of the fact that he was willing to come here shows that there's a level of excitement from people when they meet the Pegulas and what the Pegulas are willing to offer as far as ownership.
Yeah.
I own a team. You know, I've seen a lot of people beat them up on social media or complain about, they're not active enough, or Pegula didn't apologize to us after this, that, the other thing. Pegula doesn't talk enough to the media. He has no reason to. But don't ever mistake the fact that even though he doesn't do those things, he doesn't want
or
to
doesn't
win.
Care.
He doesn't care.
Right.
Because that couldn't be farther from the truth.
And, you know, when you look at it, too, and how this has sort of worked out for them, I mean, you get Gain, you get Shane, and you get some of these guys that really had been in consideration for a lot of general manager jobs across the league, including Brian Gain being brought in here to Buffalo to interview for their general manager job. So if you think about it, let's say during this process they interviewed five people. They landed two of them in their front office, one being their choice at general manager, and the other guy in Brian Gain, who's going to be running is going to be the VP of player personnel, if I'm not mistaken. So you're talking about two guys who were easily up for or considered to be up and coming general manager candidates in this league. You've now peg them for significant roles in your front office. And then you talk about a guy like Joe Shane, who is coming from the Dolphins organization, who's a young man, who's a 37-year-old guy. What I like about this and what I like about what they've done in the front office is not only have gotten young, fresh minds, but they've gotten guys that are all thinking progressively. They're all forward thinkers. They're not your average, I'm your, you know, Bill Polian disciple. I'm not a Bill Parcells disciple. I'm not one of these old-time football people who, you know, you have a line of coaches and front office personnel who are constantly thinking about the same way to win that you were winning in 1970. Mm-hmm. I want a guy who realizes the importance of draft value in 2017, not a guy who thinks ground and pound is terrific and you need three running backs to do the job. I need a guy that realizes, okay, well, this is a quarterback-driven league. I need to have a top 10, a top 7 quarterback if I'm going to be a consistent competitor in this league. I also need a team, and I need a style of play that is going to reflect the times, and knowing that you're facing teams who are, for the most part, passing 40 times a game.
I mean, I'll be honest. When they hired Bean, okay, I assumed that they would be in a hurry to start fleshing out the rest of the front office. You can assume that. Now, typically, when you're in a hurry to accomplish anything,
it's
never done well. And you run the risk, especially in this type of stuff, of just taking the first candidate who makes themselves available to you and not necessarily the best candidate. So you can imagine how shocked I was to see that they made solid hires at both not only GM, but also seemingly GM, but also assistant GM and VP of player personnel.
And they just hired, who was the gentleman they hired today?
Today they hired a new
one. Somebody as their college scouting. But another really well-respected guy who's put in a lot of years in the league, and who won the 2014 Scout of the Year award that was handed out by the league for the NFC. So you're talking about a guy who has experience, but is successful in his experience. And I think that's key, because you know, you can apply for the job and been working in sales for 15 years. If you're not a good salesman and you work for 15 years, how valuable is that experience?
Well,
it's not valuable. You want guys who have been successful, have put together teams, and to your point about Brandon Bean, a guy who's had his hand in almost every aspect of what you'd want your general manager, someone who's running the football operations portion of your organization. You want someone who has knowledge of each of those departments. And when I think, when you're talking about Doug Whaley, you know, the former GM in this position, he was strictly a pro scout. And I think it ultimately hurt his ability to manage on a personal level to say, listen, this is how things are run. I don't think he was ever really able to garner the respect of any of the two head coaches that you know, were in this organization under his tutelage. And I think ultimately what you wanted to do is have your coach and GM working in lockstep. And the only way to do that is to bring in a guy who's worked well with him in the past.
There was one thing. Gathering audio on Bean. He was on John Murphy. He was on John Murphy.
Today, right?
No, the day of his press conference.
Okay.
There was one thing that he said in the type of player that he wants.
Well, you know, we want players with character that are tough, smart. Obviously, they have to have athletic ability, the things you see on tape. But we want guys with integrity that want to work hard. And I tell you, the one thing that I really look for in the college guys coming out, who is ultra competitive? What players, you know, I asked my scouts this year at the very end, right before draft, tell me three guys in your area that are so ultra competitive they'll chew glass, they'll eat nails for their teammates, for their coaches. And it's funny to hear the different guys that come up, but those are the guys that I want, and I know Sean sees it the same way.
Now, our listeners know that they have heard something like that before.
I will chew the neck off this fucking bottle.
Drew also eats glass.
So there's a good opportunity for you in this organization, Drew.
Apparently. If I just keep grinding, keep threatening to bite the necks off beer bottles out of frustration. So, Chris, that's an important point.
Right.
I think that what they're building here is you're starting to see this whole thing take shape. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, what kind of front, you know, what kind of team is this group going to try to build?
Right.
Well, you heard it right there. They don't want flash. They want substance.
Right.
They don't want the big name. They want a guy who's willing to come in and do anything you ask him to do, and he'll go to war for you. And you need that. You need that to win at an NFL level. Look at what Bill Belichick does. And I'm not for everyone out there who's about to yell at me for this, I'm not trying to compare McDermott to Belichick. What I'm saying is there's a reason that those teams win the way that they do. And it's because he has players who will go to the mat for him because they know that there's consequences if they don't, but also because they fill their roster with guys who play with a chip on their shoulder at every position.
I also think what's important is that trust that their way, that their methodology is going to lead to success. And when you talk about guys like Bill Belichick, Mike McCarthy, some of these head coaches that have a lot of experience in winning in this league, it's those guys are easier to find when you know that your model or your methodology works. Yep. It's difficult to have guys buy in for a first-time head coach, which I think is one of the more is one of the reasons why it's been so difficult for the Bills over recent history, is because they just don't have the continuity that suggests that, hey, listen, I'm bringing you into this organization and we have a specific role that we have in mind for you to fill. Well, why is that player supposed to respect anything that you're supposed to say? You haven't done anything in this league to show, listen, I'm asking you to do something because I know that if you do it, we're going to be successful. And I think that's something important when you're talking about bringing in guys who are coming from successful organizations. You know, Brandon Bean, these guys that are coming from Carolina, who was just recently in the Super Bowl, who got to the bottom of the draft, who had the number one overall pick, and selected Cam Newton. And now you have the one of the faces of the league. This isn't just your franchise that he's a face of. He's a face of the league. And I think that's important that not only you have a proven track record of choosing players that ultimately go on to be super successful and be, you know, figureheads of the NFL, but that your methodology, that your plan, your track, your plan of attack is a successful one. And and when you can say, listen, if you do it the way I'm asking you to do it, you know, we're going to win this many games. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I did it last year. I did it 3 years ago. I just need guys in this to do what I need them to ask, what I'm asking them to do. And I think that proven track record of winning in this league, it means more than a guy that's a coach that's making, you know, $15 million or that's a big name, a Nick Saban or something. You know what I'm saying? Guys don't necessarily respect a name anymore. They respect winning.
No, and that's to your point. It's the NFL is basically the inverse of college football. College football, if you win, that's what it takes. It's hard in college because if you're a winning team like Alabama, you know, I'm a huge Alabama fan. If you're a fan of the Crimson Tide, you turn around and you say, okay, you know, I know my team's going to be good. Well, you know why they're going to be good? Because they're putting out the most talented roster every year.
Yep.
Why? Because they can recruit whoever they want. Guys would rather play for a team like that because they know they're going to get exposure. They know they're going to win games. In the NFL, it's hard because you have to convince these guys to buy in. Mm-hmm. There's no more incentive. They're getting paid now. So now you have to find something in them personally. You have to get them to buy in to who you are and what you're about and what your mission is in order to get them to perform. And it's harder to do that. I mean, that's why Nick Saban couldn't cut it in the NFL. He couldn't find a way to motivate guys who were getting paid. He just couldn't do it. So he went back to college, continued being a great head coach. Now, you look at the NFL, it's about winning. Like you said, if I'm a player, I want to know, I don't care, you know, the money obviously is a big part of it, but what are you going to do to help me win? Because that's ultimately what matters to most guys anyway. Now, this is going to be on McDermott, you know, but it seems like they're putting the right pieces in place in the front office to help get McDermott what he needs on the field in order to start trying to make that point. Mm-hmm. So then moving on here. The other interesting thing that I took away from his press conference were Bean's comments on Jim Overdorf, who was not terminated when Doug Whaley was fired a few weeks ago. I mean, this is what he had to say.
I'm coming in eyes wide open with everybody, so I don't. It shouldn't be about Jim. I've known Jim for a long time, have a lot of respect for him, great man. I've never got to work with Jim, so I'm going to jump in. I just spoke to Jim a few minutes ago and said a hello and look forward to getting to know his process, how he does things. I'm going to kind of influence him with how I do things, and we'll see how this works and go from there.
Now, that audio comes in from BuffaloBills.com. Now, I've been one of the biggest proponents of firing this guy. I mean, we've got a lot of bad contracts in our books. As evidence
is
by
this Monas or Overdorf?
Overdorf.
Okay.
Monas is already fired.
Okay. As evidence of the fact that we're a team with salary cap problems that doesn't have a highly paid franchise quarterback anywhere on our roster. This isn't supposed to be his area of responsibility. And I think it's something that he deserves to lose his job over. But Bean, by his own admission, has decided to be pragmatic about this. He's kind of treated the situation as a clean slate, quote unquote. His desire to at least attempt to work with Overdorf, I think, kind of speaks to the fact that he's not a reactionary. And instead, he's taking a wait-and-see approach with him.
Well, you heard it in his thing. He's like, I'm going to show him, you know, how I do things, which is the way we're going
to
do things.
He wants
and
to
if
see
he doesn't like it, you know, get bent, Overdorf.
He wants to see if he can help him salvage his career. I mean, Nate, what do you think about that?
You know, it's one of those things, too, and I think the point you just made is maybe one that's not made enough, is the salary cap purgatory that this team has put itself into, specifically Doug Whaley, should concern you, because as you just mentioned, you're not paying a franchise quarterback. These teams that are paying a quarterback $16, $17, $18 to $20 million a year, those are the teams that have an excuse to have salary cap issues. When you're talking about a team that right now isn't paying their quarterback top dollar, they're not paying your quarterback in a top five salary. So you shouldn't have the issues across your roster in terms of overpaying a tight end way more than they're worth. Signing a running back after you've traded for him. Now, don't get me wrong, Schrumpelko is a great running back. He's a top five, top three running back in this league. However, you sign him to a long-term deal immediately after trading for him that is hurting your ability to go out and make aggressive moves as a team, just the way it goes. So you talk about that, and then you talk about a couple other positions that they just really overpaid, specifically Marcell Dareus and Jerry Hughes, guys that there should have been a caveat. There's 100% the way that some of these contracts are written and the lengths, the terms, the money owed to some of these players just doesn't make sense when you're talking about a team that doesn't have a franchise quarterback. So it's interesting, but I completely agree with you that there are certain parts of how this team is built that I think was done wrong or done amateurly. And, you know, maybe Overdorf is part of that. Maybe he's part of the problem rather than the solution. But I like that the GM's coming in with sort of an open mind to allowing a guy like Overdorf, who's been with the organization for a long time, an opportunity to, you know, show his worth, show what he's capable of doing under new toolage, new leadership, because you don't know what Doug Whaley was asking him to do. You just don't. So if, as long as, you know, Brandon Bean feels comfortable with him in the role that he's currently doing, I don't see why not. He's not, to me, there's a guy like Russ Brandon who a lot of people give a lot of shit to.
I might just be naive, but I don't think he has a whole lot of hands in the football jar.
I would say he's your average, everyday higher up at whatever company you want to talk about. He doesn't have a lot to do with the everyday, but when there's a big decision to be made, he's going to be consulted on it, because he's got the tenure, he's got the trust of ownership. And, you know, for everybody that wants to give shit to Russ Brandon, I mean, you can give shit to Russ Brandon all you want. Sure, he was a big reason why Rex Ryan ended up ultimately being the coach last year, but he's also probably a big reason why Doug Whaley was fired. So as much as he's been around for some dope heads, you know, bad decisions, I think he's a guy that the organization accepts and acknowledges as a good, you know, brain to run not only the business side of the organization, but make decisions if you have a big decision on hand, like choosing a head coach or searching for a general manager. He has a lot of contacts in this league. And to think that he wasn't going to have a hand in the search for a general manager, I think was naive and foolish to think that. He just has too many contacts in this league. He's been around too long. And say what you will about, oh, he was the, you know, marketing guy for the Marlins, that's his only experience. Don't get me wrong, I get it, but he's done a hell of a job. You, me, all of us season ticket holders who continue buying tickets every year just ensure that he's going to have a job the next season, because he does such a great job of bringing in,
engaging the fans.
Correct.
I mean, he puts asses in the seats. So I guess the one thing I want to close with here is we talk about the restructuring of the front office. The overarching theme of all of these hires that I see, I pick out three things: experience, communication, and accountability. Now, I think if you look at the quality of the hires that the Pegulas have made, there's a sense that they've learned something from their last few years here, their inaugural, you know, their rookie season here as owners. You know, they've made it through the first phase where they've hired and fired their first GMs. Mm-hmm. They've hired and fired their first coaches. You look at the type of people they've had to fire. And I mean, it you see a common thread that I almost think speaks to who they've hired now. GM Tim Murray, he's a meticulous guy, not afraid to gamble with draft capital and what he has in his system. Questionable with communication, and I think he kind of overplayed his hand in some senses when it came to building a roster. GM Doug Whaley, again, gambled with draft capital, you know, struggled to maintain relationships with his coaches. And all most of his positive roster moves could sort of be offset by the miscues and errors he made in other places with contracts and things of that nature. Then you look at Coach Dan Bielsma for the Sabres organization. Experienced coach that struggled to tailor his system to the talent of his roster and had difficulty communicating with some of his players. Coach Rex Ryan for the Buffalo Bills. Experienced coach that tried to force his system onto players that weren't suited for it. Essentially couldn't tailor his system to the strengths of his team, and then ran a team that was undisciplined and had major communication issues. Again, you look at the from McDermott to Bean to their most recent hires, what we're seeing is that these men have a lot of similar qualities in the fact that they're all highly regarded, you know, they're all well-regarded people, both by their franchises and their fan bases. They are both... they're all the kind of guys who seem like they can get together and work well together. But not only that, they have years of experience doing this type of thing at a high level. Like you said, success. Not just, hey, I have experience. I have experience and I have success with that experience. I feel like that is the theme of all of these hires. And I mean, personally, what are your overall thoughts on this? Is it a positive thing and should Bills fans be excited?
I don't think there's any reason for any Bills fan to be discouraged about the hires of not only the front office, but a guy like Sean McDermott. I really love the new head coach. I think this new approach where he's sort of your one voice, but I do think it's pretty funny. I don't know if this is something you guys noticed, but obviously being a new GM, he was going to be in front of the spotlight a little bit. He was going to do some interviews. He was going to... I don't think this whole one voice approach was because they really wanted one voice. I think it was they were terrified of Doug Whaley making any more embarrassing media remarks.
Oh.
I think they had lost all trust in Whaley to go in front of a camera, go in front of a microphone. So it's going to be interesting now seeing just how much Brandon Bean is included in on not only, you know, media outings, but just, you know, being the voice of this team. Because ultimately, as much as you'd love your head coach to be the voice of your team, he's got a lot of responsibility on, you know, the day-to-day, where the general manager is really supposed to be the guy that's sort of, you know, kind of heads the ship. He's the captain of your ship. He's the guy. He's the guy bringing in people. But no, I think with what they've done in terms of who they've brought in for, you know, each specific scouting position, and also Brandon Bean, I think that they've assembled a stable of really good, young-minded, progressive thinkers of the game. And you know, being a guy who's pretty damn critical of the team. I feel very good with the direction in which that they're going. They're not choosing names. They're not choosing recognition over actual success. They've realized.
I feel like
that
they've learned their lesson from
with Bielsma and Rex Ryan.
Pick. You make the sexy pick, and a lot of times you pay for it. Now they're going for guys with substance, guys with, you know, resumes that can back up a little bit of the bravado that they bring to the table. And yet they're humble guys. And by all accounts, they're great communicators. So I can't wait to see what these guys can produce for this team. Hopefully they're the group that finally gets us over the hump.
I completely agree, and I hope so too.
So as we sit here and wax poetic about, you know, I think the great moves that were made over the course of the last week or two, as far as putting together this front office and how quickly it's all kind of come together. I mean, these are the guys who are going to hopefully bring the Bills into prosperity. You know, they're going to, these are, if you're setting out to make a team to break a 17-year drought, I feel like the Pegulas have gotten themselves at least off to a good start by surrounding themselves with this caliber of front office talent. But when we're talking about surrounding yourself with talent, that's what the NFL draft is all about. And that's what we're about to shift gears into, because we have more Bills draft recap to go over. And none are bigger than our fifth round selection of Nathan Peterman, quarterback out of Pittsburgh University.
You are my possession.
Now, Nate, that's one of the biggest reasons we brought you on the show tonight.
My only question in this is, you did your Peterman work with Eric before the draft. How good does it feel that we drafted him?
The guy that me and him
yeah. after putting in all that work.
Well, you know, we had heard some rumblings that there had been some connections between Peterman and the Bills. So what we wanted to do, he was really the first quarterback that there was substantial talk about being connected to the Bills, and for good reason. I think he fits a lot of what Rick Dennison is trying to do offensively on the, you know, for this team moving forward this year as the offensive coordinator. So, you know, we looked into a little bit about what this guy was about, and you know, after, you know, doing extensive research, we came back with, you know, this is my personal opinion. He was my eighth ranked quarterback amongst other quarterbacks. I mean, the quarterback that was ranked two spots ahead of him in Jarrod Evans went undrafted. So
did he sign?
He did, and I don't know with who, and it's too bad because I, to be honest, Jarrod Evans for me, Virginia Tech's quarterback. I mean, this is a young guy who I thought the Bills really should look at because I thought he, but he's a lot like Cardale Jones.
Yep.
Not a lot of starts.
Not a lot of experience. Not a lot of
Peterman's a little different than that though.
Now I got some flack. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got some flack on social media, specifically on Reddit over the weekend by listeners of our show who haven't been listening very long. And claimed that it was annoying that I was being negative about our first three draft picks. I feel like that's hilarious when you consider that I'm usually on the other side of the fence when it comes to everything yeah. Bills related. But if any of them decided to come back to listen to tonight's show, you'll be pleased to know that this pick was one that got me excited. It was one of the biggest reasons that, you know, I look at this draft and I don't see it as, oh man, you know, I'm all doom and gloom. Now, you look at who Nathan Peterman is. He's Pro Football Focus's second-rated player from the Senior Bowl. Zay Jones was number one.
So you got both.
Zay Jones was number one.
Were they on the same team?
Nathan Peterman was number two.
They were.
His highlight tape shows that he can throw with anticipation,
mm-hmm.
wide receivers breaking into windows, something that the Bills haven't had.
In quite a while.
I mean, you mm-hmm. look at what Tyrod Taylor is. He is a quarterback who needs to see it first, and then he'll throw it. Mm-hmm. I've been saying that for forever. This is a kid who can throw with anticipation, which you have to be able to do at the NFL level to be a successful quarterback. He looks patient in the pocket. It's hard to watch. Hard to find a player where he gets truly flustered when he's in the pocket. He's scanning. He uses his mobility to shift around inside the pocket. And he also has some natural speed and escapability to get out of the pocket, roll away from pressure. I mean, his, in fact, under pressure, Nathan Peterman is almost elite. Listen to this. Ooh. He finds a hot read very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Under pressure, this last season, as the starting quarterback for Pittsburgh University, his QBR was 114.7, which is this draft class' best under pressure QBR. Versus you look at a guy like Deshaun Watson. You know, the Houston Texans traded up to get him in the first round. You pressure Deshaun Watson, his QBR is 87.6. And the draft class as a whole, the average is 66.9. Do you know what makes some of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play football great? The fact that when you send a blitz in their face, they don't panic. They find an open receiver and get the ball out. What does Tom Brady do to the Bills every time we try, we think we have a blitz scheme that, oh, we're going to get Tom Brady. We're going to put him on his ass. He just gets the ball out.
Yeah.
This kid seems, I can see why people make that comparison, the Tom Brady comparison.
Mm-hmm.
He gets the ball out quickly and accurately, and he reads the whole field very quickly.
Here's what I'll tell you. I mean, when I look at Peterman, he, to me, kind of projects as a career backup, a guy that can come in and not be a step off of who your starter is, really, no yep. matter who your starter is. When you look at some advanced statistics, and this was something that I looked at pretty in-depthly, was his accuracy on balls from at the line of scrimmage from 1 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, 16 to 20, 21 to 25, and 25 plus. Okay, and none of these categories does Peterman lead amongst the top 10 quarterbacks listed on Optimum Scouting's 2017 NFL Draft Guide, which I used pretty adamantly throughout my evaluation of a lot of these quarterbacks. Where Peterman was really successful, and that was at balls at the line of scrimmage. Now, people will say, well, this is a quarterback that only throws balls at the line of scrimmage. Well, won't you, if that's the case, don't you want a quarterback who is extremely successful at those? He isn't throwing them at receivers' feet. He isn't throwing it yep. over their head. He had one incompletion all season at balls thrown at the line of scrimmage. So you know that if he is going to be – what he's asked to do, he was able to do well. He was able to execute well. So in that, he was 31 of 32 at balls at the line of scrimmage. From 1 to 5 yards, 82% completion percentage, he was 43 of 52. Now, this is the area where I'm a little bit worried about, and you mentioned, is the anticipatory throws really kind of from the 5 to 15-yard range. Those are your intermediate routes. Mm-hmm. Peterman ranked at 56% completion percentage at balls 6 to 10 yards, 28 of 50, and from 11 to 15, 26 of 57 or 45, a little over 45%. So those intermediate throws are still a little bit lower than where I'd like them to be. So this is a quarterback that necessarily was asked to throw a ton in that intermediate section, but struggled in when he did throw there. And then when you're talking about 16 to 20 yards, this is a guy who's throwing 65% and 21 to 25, 58%. However, when the ball is traveling 25 yards plus in the air, he only has 15 attempts, which is actually the lowest amongst all of the quarterbacks. So he wasn't asked to air the ball out by any means.
He wasn't. But now here's where, and this is where I think that sometimes these advanced statistics, they confuse the hell out of me, because here you are, you're giving me all these statistics that says that this guy can't, he doesn't sound like an accurate quarterback, and he doesn't sound like he can throw a good deep ball at all, right? It doesn't sound like he throws for many air yards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I look at the numbers and I say, okay, according to NFL.com, Nathan Peterman completed 46% of all deep passes. That's 25 yards or more. 46% of them. And according to Pro Football Focus, he averaged 9.6 yards per attempt, which was the 7th in all of NCAA football. So what is it then? You're telling me that he's not – you're telling me that he's not accurate, or that his accuracy struggles at some
say,
levels.
I would say maybe what I'm saying is his proficiency in throws – and you know, this maybe give you a better idea, and when they're talking about the best of each area. So Optimum Scouting breaks it down into four categories: left outside, left middle, right middle, right outside, as being the four categories of who the best in each area is. And then you go into the yardage of 1 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15. So you're wanting to know, where does Peterman come in as the best of where is he the best? And what Optimum Scouting comes up with is that 1 to 5 area in the right middle and that 1 to 5 area in the right outside. You don't see him really show up anywhere else other than the left middle at 16 to 20 yards. So then what you have to ask yourself is, where's the bulk of his success? And it's really at balls at the line of scrimmage. So, and this is something that I noticed when I was really diving into him, especially his senior year at Pittsburgh, is a good majority of the balls that he threw downfield, or the good majority of his plays, ended up happening right at the line of scrimmage on these little, I guess what you would call shovel passes, which were to James Conner at the line of scrimmage, where he was almost running a triple option and had the opportunity to run, pitch to his running back who was coming out to the outside of him, or pitch to a tight end or running back that was coming underneath, which is technically considered a forward pass. So a lot of his passing statistics his senior year were convoluted a little bit, because a lot of the yardage, the yards after catch, the touchdowns came on shovel passes, which is really just a pitch 3 or 4 yards up the field. So difficult to really, I guess, evaluate. If you're looking at quarterbacks by the numbers, you're going to look at Peterman, you're going to be a little bit unimpressed. This isn't a guy that had 4,000 yards as a senior, a guy that, you know, passed for 30 touchdowns. That's not the guy for you. But what Peterman does is he was extremely efficient in what he was asked to do. And I think that's what you ultimately have to judge a guy on, is what were they asked to do? How did they carry out that task? And ultimately, their success rate. What was their success rate? So he was asked to throw the ball short at or around the line of scrimmage. Did he do it successfully? Absolutely, he did. So for me, when you're talking about a quarterback, you can't say, oh, well, he was only 6 of 20 on balls of 25-plus yards. Well, he threw the ball 20 times 25-plus yards.
Yep.
Where are the majority of his throws? Where does his rate on the majority of his throws come? Well, they're at or around the line of scrimmage. Was he successful doing that? Yes, he was. Now, you talk about the intangibles, the size, the strength, the ability to move around in the pocket, the ability to maneuver with inside the confines of the pocket, and most importantly, his ability, his leadership ability. But I think the most important thing, and you mentioned earlier, is the anticipation that he uses. I think it's one of the most underrated parts of any quarterback analysis. When you're looking at a quarterback, how does he throw the ball when a guy isn't looking?
Yep.
When is he releasing the ball? Is it after his receiver has made the turn or made a break for the ball? Or is that ball out because he knows where he's going and why he's going there? And I think those are two important things, because when you're evaluating a quarterback, there's a, I guess, the idea that where he's throwing the ball is important. It's absolutely an important reason as to, hey, why is this quarterback throwing the ball here? But I think what's more important, or why, you know what I'm saying, is the why. Why is he throwing to a specific spot? Well, that's because the defense tells you in a cover two that a shallow dig route will be open in between the numbers at 5 to 10 yards. Mm-hmm. So where do you want that ball thrown? You want that ball thrown before he makes his break to beat that defender. So in theory, you're looking or hearing from a guy that really was successful in those anticipatory throws, which I think when you look at some of the best quarterbacks in this league, Tom Brady,
Aaron Rodgers,
Cam Newton, these are guys that are throwing the ball with confidence, but they're throwing the ball before their receivers make their breaks, and it's because they know the offense. They know how to how their offense beats elite defenses, and how you beat elite defenses is with timing. Is there are certain plays, there are certain routes, there are certain balls that can't be defended in this league. Ultimately, when you're evaluating a quarterback, what you want from him is the ability to know why their offense is doing what it's doing because of what the defense is showing. And when you're talking about back shoulder throws, find on film for me more than a handful of instances this team even ran back shoulder throws. They didn't.
Well, they don't, and I'll tell you why. And this kind of leads into why this is one of my favorite draft picks of this class. You're talking about you're a team that has a quarterback who's highly athletic, and he has an arm. He's shown he can uncork it. He can throw the ball down the field. He can do Tyrod Taylor can do a lot of good things for you. One of the things he will never do for you is throw with anticipation. He is a see it then throw it quarterback. Maybe he'll grow into that role this season and he'll prove me wrong, but I don't feel confident in that.
Right.
I honestly believe you see a lot of his passes. He doesn't see wide open receivers running down the field. He misses a lot. Every game, you can go back and watch film and see guys running open somewhere in the field. During that Baltimore game that we lost because we only scored one touchdown, Robert Woods wide open, beat the safeties. The safeties both sank. Mm-hmm. He's wide open, and Tyrod Taylor just decides to run. You need a quarterback who can scan the field efficiently, effectively, and can throw before a guy needs to get to the break. That's what you need in order to make a West Coast offense work. Mm-hmm. That's why I have fear for where we're going to go this season. I like this pick because, like you said, even if he is only a career backup,
teams are in need
of career backups. He gives you that guy that you can go to, a Frank Reich type. A guy that, hey, I can execute inside of this offense, and I'm not going to – I may not be as good as Jim Kelly, but I'm not going to be Billy Joe Hobert. you know what I mean? Yeah. Now, when I look at this, I have a couple thoughts before I give my grade. You look at what John Gruden said about him, and I know a lot of people are going to pan, oh, John Gruden blows everybody. John Gruden loves every quarterback he sees. The comments that I picked out about him – he, in an interview with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, John Gruden says he was asked the question, which quarterback out of this entire class would you be comfortable with rolling out right now? If you were to take the sideline as a head coach, who would you pick? He said, I would take the kid from Pitt. Why? He'd allow us to do just about anything in the game plan. I think he throws the ball pretty darn good. He's athletic and very, very sharp. I think he's a lot like Andy Dalton to me. He reminds me of Dalton so much coming out of TCU. I'd probably go with Peterman if I had to play with him in a few months.
I'd say comped out-wise, he's a Kirk Cousins, Andy Dalton. I absolutely agree with that.
And so to that point, the fact that we got him in the fifth round, when everything I read said he was a third round,
no
fourth
question.
Round prospect,
no
that's
question.
A steal.
Some people talked about a second round grade on Nate Peterman. I'm going to tell you a couple of statistics that do worry me a little bit. And, you know, these are coming from his senior year. They're not necessarily a trend, but they're certainly something to pay attention to. Accuracy and accuracy percentage in the fourth quarter, 50%. 36 of 72 in the fourth quarter. So when his team is trailing or behind or however you want to put it, in the fourth quarter, he's at 50% completion percentage. His explosive pass percentage, so these are plays that either lead to touchdowns or large plays, which is just about anything above 25 plus yards. 9.72% or 7 of 72, which is the second lowest amongst qualifying quarterbacks in the draft. Loss of yards slash turnover percentage, 4.17%. Or in this case, sort of middle of the pack when you're talking about guys. So, yes, I agree with you that Nate Peterman has shown an ability to be ready to play or be ready to be thrown at whatever is going to be thrown at him at the NFL level. I guess my biggest worry is this just another? And I think when you're talking about Bills quarterbacks and you're talking about who needs to ultimately be the guy that runs this organization from the quarterback position, it's someone that can be leaned upon in crunch time to make maybe not – Here's what it is, and I think maybe too much is made about the guy who can make the play opposed to a guy that won't make a specific play inside the fourth quarter, the mistake, the interception, the fumble. Mm-hmm. And you saw last year in only one instance, we had been waiting for Tyrod Taylor to sort of have his coming out party in the fourth quarter. Well, that game was the Miami Dolphins. They ultimately end up losing. In
because of our defense. Our defense Correct. Folded. Tyrod Taylor should have – he showed what you needed to be as a quarterback to win that game, which is the one thing that gives me kind of some confidence going some into the season. It, yeah. Now, the reason I like this Peterman pick so much and the reason why I gave it an A draft grade, the highest grade out of any pick in this class, is because – I look at it and I say, what would E.J. Manuel give me as a backup? What would Cardale Jones give me as a backup? Mm-hmm. It sounds an awful lot like Nate Peterman could probably beat them both out for that job if he had a full training camp under his belt.
Nate, no question. How do you see that playing out in August? Because we're not going to carry four quarterbacks.
No.
I mean, Tyrod Cardale, Nate Peterman, and T.J. Yates. Who's the one that gets cut?
A lot of people are going to say it's going to be Cardale Jones that gets cut. Because T.J. Yates is a guy that if your quarterback goes down, he's won a playoff game. He's a guy that has NFL starting experience. Mm-hmm. However, when you're talking about taking the three best players, now I don't know if the decision is do we take the best three players at the position, because I think ultimately that decision comes down to then Peterman and Cardale with Tyrod. I think those are the three most talented players at the position. However,
experience
plays a role.
A lot.
It certainly plays a role. However, I even though I think a lot of people are down on Cardale because the former pro personnel department is the guy that drafted or the people that drafted Cardale. However, I think when you're talking about raw talent, Cardale still has probably the best raw talent on this team. It's about coaching, and ultimately, I still think that Cardale has the tools to be this a starting quarterback in this league. Whether it's with the Bills,
that's a bold statement.
Listen, I think when you're talking about arm strength, you're talking about arm strength, athleticism, and the ability to throw balls where other players can't. When you're talking about a handful of players that can make throws, you're talking about, I would say, about 15% of starting quarterbacks can make the throws that Cardale Jones makes.
I hate to be the guy who tries to say, "Hey, I got the last word," but I'm the host of the show and I'm going to do what I want.
Absolutely,
I know another guy who could throw a ball through the uprights.
His name is Jamarcus Russell.
From his knees, and his name was Kyle Bowler. How great was Kyle Bowler in the NFL?
True.
Yeah. So arm strength, you have all the arm strength Correct. In the world. You don't.
I think what you have to do is when you go back and you watch that Indianapolis Colts preseason game, you see a handful of throws that make you sit back and you say, "Wow, that is not only a throw that you need your starter to make." But it's a throw in the fourth quarter when they're down, they're driving. Specifically, the throw to Walt Powell, where he ends up taking it.
They could have forced overtime by kicking the field goal.
They could have, but they went for the win. The throw to Walt Powell and the throw to, I believe it was Walt Powell or Brandon Tate on the sidelines. There are two throws that continue to stick out to me, and you can go on any, Cardale Jones or Buffalo Bills preseason highlight film, and you're going to see those two plays because they stuck out to me as wow plays that not a lot of guys can make. And even though you Cardale Jones leaves a little bit to be desired in the consistency portion, what you love to see are plays that not many players can make. That's Cardale Jones. He can make plays that a lot of quarterbacks in this league cannot make, but can he do it consistently? And I think that's been the biggest issue, not only for him and his professional prospects moving forward, but for this organization to decide, listen, is this a guy we're going to give a legitimate opportunity to some point win this job? Because if it's not, if you look at Cardale Jones, is yes, he has the potential, but he's not
a guy.
But I feel
like they would. But I feel like they wouldn't have drafted Nathan Peterman if
maybe
they
not.
But if they were comfortable.
But you know what the thing is?
If they were comfortable, they would not have drafted.
Maybe you're
Nathan
right.
Peterman.
But you know what? Maybe it came down to your board where Nathan Peterman was available in the fifth round, and you had a third round grade on him, and there was no way you could pass on Nathan Peterman. And I think that has a lot to do with why the Bills took him. Is he was available in the fifth round to them. I think they let him pass by him, let them pass by the team in the fourth round, thinking, okay, well, if this guy's around in the fifth round, there's no way we can let him pass by right now. But the fourth round, they didn't have that pick. So they had that they had that fifth round pick,
they
and they said,
wait.
You know what?
Like, the kid's still on the board.
He's still on the board. We have a third round grade on him. We would be doing ourselves a disservice by not taking a guy
Stick
like this.
Stick to the board, take Stick the best the player board. Available, and it happens to be the quarterback. Now, you just primed it up for us because this is going to be one of the best camp battles to watch this year. You know, last year it was at a couple different positions, whether it was, you know, last year was wide receiver to see who else was going to flesh out the depth chart. Right now, there is a real battle going on this roster as far as quarterback is concerned, because like Chris said, I do not see a universe in which they keep they keep four.
It's tough. Yeah, no, we're
not the Jets.
However,
we're not the Jets.
They might think about it now.
Boo.
Maybe listen to this. Maybe you interchange a third kicker with a fourth quarterback.
A third kicker with a fourth quarterback.
Because, I mean, they had three kickers on the roster last year.
At this point, hopefully no coach in the NFL is dumb enough to keep three kickers
except
around.
For the Bills.
So, year, at the end of the day, what do you give the grade of the draft pick in the fifth round, Nathan Peterman?
Fifth round, it's difficult for me to move away from the A spot. I'm going to give him an A minus.
High five.
I'm going to give him an A minus, and I'm going to tell you this because I had a third or fourth round grade on him. The fact that he fell to them in the fifth round and could potentially help them down the road as a long-term backup option. If that's all Peterman is, you spending a fifth-round pick on him is tremendous value.
Oh,
I mean, you talk about
found money.
You talk about the one draft that always will stick out to me is the RG3 Andrew Luck draft, where RG3 is taken second overall and Washington takes Kirk Cousins later in that fifth round. And you look back and you say, well, why the hell did they take Kirk Cousins if they had taken a quarterback in the second round? Well, look. One guy's out of the league, and it's not the fifth round pick.
Man, guys, all this draft talk. We're going to move on to our, as we do every week, AFC East Roundup. We are going to talk about the Patriots draft recap.
People call it the Boston accent. It's not an accent. It's a whole city of people saying most words wrong.
Dante Scarnecchia is a fantastic offensive line coach. We all know that. But, I mean, he's working miracles with that kid.
Ladies and gentlemen, Christian Simonelli in the house. How are you doing, brother? We haven't heard from you in a while.
I was doing pretty good until that intro. I didn't realize how thick my accent was.
Working miracles with that kid.
It's hilarious. So
that's great.
So, Christian, I'll admit that it was a little hard for me to talk to you after the Super Bowl because, you know why I couldn't bring it to couldn't bring
what
myself
happened?
To I couldn't
the
bring
the Patriots are up 28-3, right? Is that what it was? I forgot.
No,
Drew,
what happened was that I ended up passing on my the basement floor down on my wet bar. I ended up just passing out down.
After you want to know why it was a wet bar? Because he wet his pants.
I took my shirt off, yelled at my girlfriend, woke up on the basement floor, was like, wow, that was the Super Bowl.
That was understandable.
So for our new listeners who don't know who Christian Simonelli is, he is a diehard Patriots fan, and he is I don't know if you guys know the PFW In Progress show. He is a routine caller. You know, he's the occasional, I guess you've guest hosted, Christian?
Yeah, once. Yeah, actually twice, but yeah.
Twice. So he's very familiar with the inner workings of the Patriots. He's talked on the radio before. People seem to respect his opinion, even though he says it with a thick accent. So, Christian, the Patriots have had a busy offseason. I mean, since the last time we talked to you about anything, your front office, I mean, look at the moves. You've signed Stephon Gilmore in free agency, you jackass.
Bust. Yep.
Inked Mike Gillisley to a 2-year deal in free agency. You re-signed Dont'a Hightower, Alan Branch, and Ronnie Harmon, you know, key members of your team. Then you traded for defensive lineman Coney Ealy, tight end Dwayne Allen, and wide receiver Brandon Cooks, who was arguably one of the most explosive weapons on the New Orleans Saints team. And I would say probably the best wide receiver that Tom Brady has played with since you guys had Randy Moss.
I would agree with that. Sure. Yeah, they've been very busy. You know, Patriots had their draft in March, apparently, based on the moves, and certainly with only four picks, not having a pick till the third round this year. I love the aggressiveness. I always have. I always have loved the aggressiveness that this team does not rest on their laurels, that even though they won the Super Bowl, they were down 28-3, and they were really getting it taken to them by the Falcons. I mean, the Falcons' speed was incredible in that game. And I just think that Bill looked at the roster and said, you know, we just got to get better at these positions, and he upgraded. Gilmore was by far the biggest surprise to me. No one saw that.
Were you more happy with free agency or the draft?
Oh, free agency by far. I mean, you got playmakers. You got, you know, established Pro Bowl players on this team. And you get Cooks, you get Gilmore, you trade for Ely. And a lot of people, you know, are hesitant to say, well, wait a minute, you know, you only get them for, you know, they're really not under your control as far as Cooks and Ely go for, like, the next year or two. But if they're really good, they'll find a way to keep them. You know, Cooks is the most intriguing to me, I think, because they exercised his fifth-year option. And in 2 years, you have no idea what the wide receiver core is going to look like. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very well Amendola and Edelman probably aren't going to be here by then. I mean, I just don't think they'll last. So, you know, with Hogan and Mitchell and with Cooks, are they going to be your starters? Who knows? But Hogan's contract is actually also up in 2 years because he signed a 3-year deal. So it's interesting. It's pretty interesting, but I love the moves they made in free agency. Yeah.
So, Christian, I guess my question is, are you worried about the land? So when you think about the moves that were made, I mean, they've traded for, and instead of taking, you know, younger players who are there's no success behind them saying that they're going to be successful NFL players. So instead, what they did is they traded those, you know, those picks for players. How concerned are you, I guess my question is, that these moves are in such a win-now mode because Tom Brady maybe has 1, maybe 2 years left? I mean, how much longer does Tom Brady really have? Does this maybe send a message to Patriots fans that they're maybe going for it in this year or next year because they've maybe heard from Tom Brady that he might be done sooner rather than later?
Well, if Garoppolo wasn't on the team, I would say no, but I'm going to say yes to your question because they held on to Jimmy, and they held on to Jimmy for one reason and one reason only. They apparently love him. Bill apparently loves him. And there were offers there this offseason, I'm sure, not just from Cleveland, but from other teams, mm-hmm. even though nothing was reported, and they didn't move him. And in a year that was essentially star for talent at the quarterback position, this was the year to do it, and they didn't. So that tells me that Bill is going to make a very difficult decision, and I think ultimately, as he's done historically in the past, even though it's Brady, and Brady's going to make it very hard for him to make that decision, I think Bill looks at it as, well, Brady, maybe you do have another 2 or 3 years left, but I think Jimmy's got 10.
Now, here's the thing I found interesting. They talked to Tom Brady, and he said in a recent interview that he seemed to almost acknowledge that fact, though. He says, hey, I understand that the best players, at the end of the day, the best player plays. Yep. Almost, and he made some more comments along that same line that almost make it sound like he would be willing to stay on the Patriots roster as a backup rather than leave to go to some other franchise and try to, you know what I mean, like a Matt Castle type thing where he goes somewhere else and tries to win, or a Joe Montana type thing where I'm going to leave, or I'm going to force the team to trade me because they have somebody younger. You know, Steve, I think the Joe Montana comparison is probably the best one. They had Steve Young in the wings, and they said, hey, we've got this guy who we know can be good. We can offload him for some capital, and that team can still be, you know, he's still got enough left in the tank to make somebody competitive for a year or two. Like Brett Favre when he signed with the Vikings. You know, what did he give him? One good year?
That's it.
But that one good year got him to the NFC title game.
Yeah.
So some team out there would love to start Tom Brady. But he made it sound an awful lot like he'd be willing to take a back seat if that's what it took in order to remain a Patriot. I just know that that's been the Patriots' bread and butter, and I almost think it would be the most delicious thing to watch them trade Tom Brady away to somebody for capital. It would be the most Belichickian thing to do.
Yeah, and I can't see Brady on the bench. I think it wouldn't work. I don't see Tom ever resigning himself to that role. I think it'd be awful for Jimmy, because as soon as Jimmy throws a pick,
yep,
it just would never happen. I mean, it'll never happen. Bill wouldn't do that because he knows how detrimental that would be to the team.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in 2008 when he hurt his knee, how many players do you always see that are hurt or on injury reserve on the sideline? Brady wasn't even anywhere near the stadium that year. Why? Because if Castle was on the field and threw a pick, they couldn't do a live shot into the booth or on the sideline and show Brady's face. I'm dead serious. Like that's how Belichick runs that ship. And you know, that's, in my opinion, because he's won so much, I defer to him. But there's no way I could see Brady taking a backseat or playing that backup role. He's just got too big of a chip on his shoulder. This is headed for two just major personality figures butting heads. I think Bill steadfast and the moves that he's made, you know, whether it's been acquiring players, releasing players, trading players, and still being successful, a la trading Jamie Collins in the middle of the season last year and yep. defense actually getting better. And then Brady saying, screw that. What are you kidding me? Like, I'm not taking a backseat. Like, there's no way. You know, look where I came, you know. I was a six-round draft pick, and I had to earn. And that's he always says, I have to earn, I have to earn. He'll say, trade me in a second. But the wild card in this whole thing is the owner and is Robert Kraft and yep. his relationship with Tom. For all intents and purposes, for everything that we see, it's super, super tight. So at the end of the day, Belichick's an employee.
Yeah, it's going to be the power struggle in your building is about to get real. You guys are heading. Yep. It's a ways off. It's on the horizon, though. There is going to come a day of reckoning in Foxborough, and I, as a Bills fan, can't wait to get some popcorn and watch it.
Oh, you guys must be relishing in that. Are you kidding me? You can finally see an end in sight.
I can see the end of the tunnel, the light at the end of the tunnel. It's coming.
I don't blame you.
So now, with all of the draft capital you guys shed making these trades, you had a pretty boring draft. Now, yep. I guess I've got questions for you on two of your prospects and about the class as a whole. The first one is defensive end Derek Rivers out of Youngstown State. You took him in the third round. He's not a household name. I mean, the Bills, I did some research on him because the Bills brought him in for a pre-draft interview.
Yep.
And at least kicked the tires on a lot of pass rushers during this draft. I think he could eventually become a very solid player for you guys. I mean, I'll say the things I like about him is the fact that he seems like a Jamie Collins. He can play on the line of scrimmage or he can play off the ball inside linebacker, much in the same way Jamie Collins did. And his play speed, I mean, he plays on the edge of a defense. He has the ability to play in space. He's got gap awareness. But he recognizes plays. That's going to be important because you guys draft players who are versatile. And if he can't flash that, you wouldn't have taken him.
Yeah, I really see him this year as more of a project than anything. And I think that if they get anything out of him, it's a bonus. I really do. I mean, you know, you watch, certainly, I've seen the highlights on YouTube and, you know, read the scouting reports. And I think this is definitely a pick that is eyed towards 2018 rather than this upcoming season. Mm-hmm. I think that even though they've lost Sheard and Long, and Ninkovich is certainly getting up there, you know, I think that they have enough with Trey Flowers. I think they have enough with Coney Ealy. I think they have enough with Lawrence Guy, who they signed, that they'll be able to sort of mix and match up front. In addition, maybe Hightower sees a little bit more time on the line like he did in the Super Bowl to get some extra pressure. Mm-hmm. But I like the kid because he is versatile, and that's a typical Bill Belichick pick. Small town school, versatile player. A player that arguably probably could have went in the second round. You got in the third, the whole value tag attached to it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, typical Patriots pick.
I mean, I'll be honest. The only things I didn't like about him was that his technique and his field awareness. I mean, watching his tape, he looked like – the thing I kept thinking in my head is that he looks like a just past his prime Aaron Schobel. No, because most of his sacks and his pressures are really just come from the fact that he doesn't stop working. He doesn't stop working to get off blocks. So if you give him enough time, he'll eventually get home and he'll eventually, you know, pressure the passer, or he'll eventually fight his way in the backfield. But one of the big things I noticed again about him is that he lowers his head after you block him. You know, he launches himself into his blocker so with his head down, he wants to defeat that block. So what ends up happening is he gets so disoriented, running backs run right past him. You know, he finally gets off his man, and the running back is a yard and a half upfield already.
Yeah, he does that in the NFL, and he's going to have a short career.
Exactly.
I can guarantee you they'll correct that.
So if you had to grade the pick, what would you give it? A, B, C, D?
You know, I'd give it a B. I think it's a solid B pick for him.
And then the other pick that really intrigued me for you guys, Antonio Garcia in the fourth round.
Yeah.
Now, this was a weak draft class for the offensive line. Part of the reason I was mad about the Dawkins pick for the Buffalo Bills. But last week we talked it over with a guy who does a lot of draft research and statistical stuff, and it made me feel a little bit better about it. I didn't bother scouting all, you know, I really didn't bother doing any of my own scouting. But when I read up about Garcia after the draft, I can see why you guys liked him enough to move up for him in the fourth round there. He's an aggressive blocker, and he shows a fantastic ability to mirror when it comes to just his ability in the pass protection game to mirror against pass rushers. I mean, that combined with his size is incredible. What is he, 6'5", and he's got like a 68-inch wingspan?
Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah,
Some kind of freakish wingspan that wingspan. He just gets in people's ways. And so with now, we heard it in your intro, Dante Scarnecchia. For as long as that guy stays around, the fact that he was able to work miracles with Marcus Cannon, what do you think he can do with this kid?
Well, I think at first he's probably going to challenge Fleming for the backup swing tackle role, Cameron Fleming. And, you know, certainly right now I would think that ideally starting the season he'd be third in the depth chart behind Solder and Cannon. I think it's another pick geared towards 2018, and that Solder's contract is up at the end of the year, and not sure what they're going to do with him. I don't see him getting a big money deal. He's certainly a player that potentially could stay for a team friendly deal, but you know, there's some wild card there, and I think you know the guys that mentioned this on PFW in Progress about his kid being sick, and his kid has been battling cancer. So I kind of don't know how that all sort of factors into maybe his line of thinking. I mean, he's won two Super Bowls. You know, he did get a second contract with the team. So I'm not sure what the thought process is there, but I think it's a pick that, again, that's tied really towards the future.
So you think that they basically took their draft and just punted towards next year. They were like, listen, we're going to pick guys that have future consideration for starting positions or maybe to challenge for starting jobs. But they didn't really try to reach for any impact players this coming season.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the same thing with Dietrich Wise and then the kid McDermott, the other tackle that they took. I just think it's all just sort of geared towards really depth and really in future pieces. I definitely think they punted. That's a really good word. I definitely think that they punted on the draft. Like I said, they had their draft in March.
So then I guess I just got to ask one final question. What do you give for an overall draft grade for all of the Patriots selections this year as far as what they did in the draft?
Well, if it's just for this year and if you're grading for this year, like, and I'm not projecting towards the future, I'd give them a C because I don't see any of these guys coming in and starting and giving you meaningful time. I just don't. Hopefully I'm wrong with, you know, maybe with Rivers, but I'd give it a C. I mean, it's definitely a projection draft. You know, when you have a draft, typically you want to get at least maybe one starter out of it, or one guy that's going to give you meaningful, you know, meaningful snaps. Like 2012, they drafted Chandler Jones and Dont'a Hightower in the first round. Those guys came in and started from day one. I mean, that ended up being the nucleus of rebuilding your defense. So I'd give it a C. I really would.
Man, you're hard on your boys.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, they punted. And I can't include what they did in March as part of the draft grade. You know, around here, everybody's giving them an A. It's a joke. No, you didn't draft Brandon Cooks and Coney Ealy. You traded for those players. You can't count those as draft picks.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're willing to be reasonable, Christian.
And that's why we love you
over here in Bill's country. Why don't you tell all of our listeners where they can find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Chris with a T-I-A-N.
That's Chris with the T-I-A-N on Twitter.
And I promise I'll respond back to you and just read my reply in a thick Boston accent.
And you'll understand better.
Christian, yes. Thank you so much for coming on the show this night. We appreciate it.
Guys, thanks for having me. Love the show. Keep up the great work.
Guys, thanks so much for showing up for our show tonight. We have to get out of here. Before we go, I just want to give a couple plugs. First and foremost, for those of you out there who don't know, this is your reminder. It is National Chris Gregg Awareness Month.
Wow.
Now, I am tweeting at basically every franchise that is a dog shit tight end depth chart to remind them that Chris Gregg still doesn't have a job heading into training camp.
He's actually reacted to us on Twitter.
Which is a travesty, because the guy was playing some of the best football of his career right up until a dirty hit took him out.
Definitely a dirty hit. Go fuck yourself, D'Angelo Hall.
I firmly believe that the guy needs a second chance just to prove that that wasn't a fluke and that he actually has the ability to play a solid tight end, a solid second tight end role on any team in the NFL. There's a number of teams out there, the Jets, the Browns, the Panthers, obviously the Bills, that I think could use his talents. And I'm gonna do my part and take to Twitter and social media and make sure that they don't forget about him for the next, I don't know, 17 days.
There's a certain.
I would hope that you all out there will join me in this effort.
There's a couple of teams that would enjoy the possession.
The possession
of Chris Gregg.
Yeah. Now, as far as everything else goes, guys, you can follow Nate at Nate Geary, WGR, on Twitter. You can actually check out his article on Nathan Peterman at www.coverone.net. We're going to put a link to it in the show's description. Coverone.net, obviously, you guys all know what it is. We talk about it nonstop because he covers all the shit that I don't have the time to. I don't have the aptitude to do all the X's and O's the way he does. And Nate here is single, he's got nothing but time.
I've got nothing but time.
Are you doing Sports Talk Saturday?
I am this Saturday.
There you go.
I'll be there. Fantastic. I'll be talking sports.
And what's the number if they wanted to call in?
803-0550. Wait, I got the 1-800 number. It's 1-888-552-550. Those are the numbers.
Those are the numbers, folks. If anybody here wants to call in, talk a little Buffalo sports with our boy Nate Geary. And if you want to follow Christian, as we said, at C-H-R-I-S-W-I-T-H-A,
Chris,
capital T-I-A-N.
You butchered
Chris,
that.
T-I-A-N.
It's at Chris with a T-I-A-N.
That's on Twitter. And folks, I just appreciate all of the love we've been getting recently.
Mostly because of my Bottrell jersey.
Jesus Christ.
It's very true.
Folks, we got to get out of here. Thank you so much for stopping by and listening to the podcast. We got to go. I'm Drew Geer. That's Chris Krueger.
And I'm Ashley Schaefer. No, I am Nate Geary.
That's Nate Geary. And this has been the Rock Pile Report.
It's happening daily. We're being conned by the institutions we used to trust. The mainstream media is distracting us with meaningless headlines instead of focusing on the harsh realities facing American families. Time is short before something big happens, and that's why so many folks are preparing. They're becoming self-reliant by investing in emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure 4-week emergency food kits for each member of your family. Each kit contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Save $50 on each 4-week food kit you purchase. Plus, get free shipping on Ready Hour 4-week emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour foods. At My Patriot Supply, you can also get solar power generators, water filtration units, heirloom seeds, and survival gear. Order by 3 p.m. and your unmarked boxes ship the same day. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.